It's The Wonky Show. A bold overhaul of OFS's quality regime will get across what's being done to the incredible machine. A Hillsborough law finally arrives. We'll have a think about what a duty of candor might do to universities. And apprenticeships move to the DWP. What does that mean? It's all coming up.
Very famously, with much fanfare, Ofsted managed to turn around two consultation exercises, an overhaul of their inspection framework in about 20 months. From the point of the independent review into the OFS last year to the point when there might actually be some information coming off the back of the reformed TEF, I think that's about 38 months.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to explore the week's developments, as usual, three excellent guests. In London, Andrea Turley is a partner at KPMG. Andrea, your highlight of the week, please.
Thank you, Jim. So my highlight of the week would be joining KPMG, so new joiner as of September. So really pleased to be working with a fantastic team to support the sector.
In White City, Shane Chowan is editor at FE Week. Shane, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. I returned from Denmark supporting Team UK in the Euroskills competition. And we brought home some medals. We got a bronze in Industry 4.0. We also got medals in CNC milling, hairdressing, plumbing and heating, painting and decorating, and restaurant services. So it was good to be there to cheer Team UK on and bring back some medals.
And in Belfast, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week.
Well, in Belfast for the weekend, I'm looking forward to going to a Swiftmageddon club night at the Belfast Empire on Saturday night. If you know, you know.
So yes, we start this week with quality. Debbie, the incredible machine is getting an overhaul again. What's in the mix?
Well, yeah, there's a lot to get into here. So let's cast our minds back to the Bain review of the Office for Students, one of the recommendations of which was that the quality bits that Office for Students were doing were a bit disparate and fragmented. So there was the kind of B3 outcomes element. There was the kind of risk-based, or, you know, was anyone at risk of meeting these conditions, they need to be investigated. And then there was the teaching excellence framework, which was the sort of enhancement element. Bain review suggested that these should be brought together into a single, integrated and cohesive approach. And what we've got now, what just landed this morning, is a consultation on the kind of, I guess, sort of superstructure of what that approach will look like. There'll be another consultation on the kind of, you know, the actual sort of process next year, which I think is quite, in some ways, quite unhelpful in itself. But that's, you know, I guess that's for discussion. The key proposals here is that the TEF would become the centre of a new system. So that thresholds regulation on those student outcomes would be integrated into the TEF. It would be done on a cyclical basis, depending on the level of risk identified in the last, in the last TEF. So if you do less well in your TEF assessment, then you'll be assessed more frequently in the future. There's also some element of consequences for your TEF award. So if you get a requires improvement or a bronze, you'll be subject, you may be find yourself with restrictions on your ability to recruit students in the future. Greater regulatory oversight and all the rest of it. If you get silver or gold, possibly you might find that there are access to funding streams that would not otherwise have been available to you. But that's all sort of to be determined. There's lots of like little bitty changes running through, which I think we'll get into. But I think the kind of key thing to take away is just that the TEF is going to be the thing, the way that we assess quality going forward. That's the proposal on the table.
And am I right, Debbie? Just to sense check this, because I've been really busy over the past 48 hours. I know DK has done, as usual, a great rattle through of all the key things on the site. So do take a look at that if you get a chance. But is it basically they're gluing together the TEF and the sort of B3 investigation regime and then making some tweaks along the way?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a lot of tweaks. And there's quite a lot of little mini elements and lots of little decisions have been made along the way. But yeah, fundamentally, yeah, you get every institution that is on the OFS register will get a TEF review every 3 to 5 years. And that's the quality system. And they'll look at the experience, they'll look at the outcomes, and they will, on the one hand, you will go into a kind of risky category where you get more stuff, kind of more oversight, more, you know, implications for your ability to award degrees and recruit students. And on the other side, you get give it a green flag and told to, you know, go with God.
Fascinating. Now, before we get into some of the features of what's being proposed here, Shane, if we just zoom out a little bit and ask ourselves, right, okay, for example, how does this compare with what goes on in further education? What strikes you?
I think what strikes me first, Jim, is the amount of time that the Office for Students is taking to sort this out. So very famously, with much fanfare, Ofsted launched its Big Listen in March 2024.
following the tragic death of the primary head teacher, Ruth Perry. They managed to turn around two consultation exercises, an overhaul of their inspection framework for early years schools, further education, apprenticeships in universities, and initial teacher training. They managed to do all of that and then start inspections in November in about 20 months. From the point of the independent review into the OFS last year to the point when there might actually be some information coming off the back of the reformed TEF, I think that's about 38 months. So it's taking the OFS twice as long as Ofsted did to introduce something new and apparently better. And Ofsted said they weren't going fast enough. By the way, Ofsted wanted to go faster. Meanwhile, the sector is saying, well, you're going too fast. So obviously pacing is an issue. But as well, I just think given where the OFS sits in the sector, is this really what it should be spending its time doing? We know they had to pause, obviously, the register because they were focusing on finances. Those finances aren't getting any better. There's mergers on the cards. There's a white paper before Christmas. There's ongoing franchise reform. There's a lifelong learning entitlement. It just strikes me as a lot of work for reward some way down the line. This is great news, by the way, for the nation's 15-year-olds that have just started year 11, because I think they're the first ones that are going to be able to secure any benefits from the kinds of better information on quality that we're being promised today.
All hail the 15-year-olds. Extraordinary. Now, Andrea, I guess one of the controversies that will stand out for people is this idea that if you get bronze or you get requires improvement, you're going to have your student number growth restricted. How do you think that'll go down?
That's a very good question. And in reading through the Wonky blog this morning and the consultation paper, I think it's going to be a point of considerable feedback as part of the consultation. So I think it's interesting. They do reference in the paper around student perception around gold, silver and bronze. And I think there'll be feedback around the clarity of bronze and that redefining what that actually means, where it meets minimum standards, but not necessarily expectations, might get a bit of a confusion type of narrative running through the consultation. I think it probably won't be well received by the sector, that would be something that would play through. I think it will be interesting to see the rationale as to, they're very clear on the punitive, potentially, rather than the incentives, I think, for both gold, silver, and definitely for bronze in that punitive. But I'm not sure that would be well received by the sector, or more information might be requested in terms of what that means and how that might play through.
Debbie, let me test a thought on you, right? So when there's loads of students around and the number of 18-year-olds is kind of growing and people are kind of competing to recruit them and the sector's fairly stable, an expansion incentive seems to make sense. But of course, we're living through a period where when one provider expands, it's very obvious that other providers are now contracting. And, you know, there's real punishment, isn't there, for the providers who get silver and bronze being then meted out on other providers potentially? Or am I overcooking that?
I think that based on the last round of assessments, we're not talking about very many providers who are at risk of getting requires improvement or bronze. So there's a question, I suppose, about whether you raise the standard and then you've got, you know, so, and actually that tended to be smaller providers, newer providers, with the caveat that, of course, small and new providers are not also, you know, there may be a sort of maturing question, and in some cases is a genuine quality question. So I might not overcook that. What I would say, I suppose, is that if you think about the kind of broad agendas for government, one is about saying, how can we diversify provision specifically, and think about kind of the right sorts of institutions delivering the right sorts of courses, you know, whatever you may feel about that, and to the right groups of students, and and that question about how can the higher education sector deliver on government priorities more closely in terms of skills and the industrial strategy strands and sort of regional economic development. I do not think that this quality that awarding silvers and golds and saying that we expand on that basis dovetails very well with that agenda. And it might not need to, because as I say, that kind of question about whether you can kind of put in restrictions on the basis of quality may just be answering a completely different agenda, which is about making sure that everything that is delivered is of a decent quality as far as possible. But there's some kind of disconnect, I think, between thinking about what is happening at the system and about the incentive, and it's actually really unclear to me what the incentives that that are being imagined here today are in some ways. You know, I think the incentive is to sort of tell a very good story about what is going to be an increasingly, you know, one aspect of provision, which is the full-time undergraduate experience. And then there's this whole bunch of other things that you might be sort of hoping to and wanting to deliver as part of the government's agenda. And then that's not being assessed until, you know, 2030 something.
Shane, let me cause you to draw to think about those 15-year-olds again. There's two things I think. So one of the things I was doing last night, actually, I was rereading the actual evaluation OFS commissioned on applicant behaviour. And, you know, one, they don't really know what these things mean. And I'm not sure if we explained it, they'd be particularly happy because it looks very complicated. Mm. But two, all the indicators in here are extraordinarily lagged. And, you know, I'm not sure there's a university in England right now that is the size and shape and the range of courses and the type of services and so on that it had 2 years ago, given the amount of, you know, redundancies and change and so on. It hasn't really fixed either of those problems, has it?
No, it hasn't. And if anything, what the consultation published today really says to me is that the OFS is fundamentally confused about what it's there to deliver. And as much as the lofty forwards that we continually read talk about the, you know, role of the regulator in, you know, standing up for students, standing up for quality, actually what I see is a sector body largely talking to the sector and not much beyond that. So, you know, increasingly we know this already from the kinds of research that you mentioned, Jim. Young people and their families, when applying to colleges, when applying to universities, they're not looking at the OFS website to inform their choices. You know, they're looking at they have access to lots of information, which is, you know, a positive that there is a kind of marketplace of information out there in higher education. We don't have that in apprenticeships. We don't have that in further education. So there are of course lessons we can learn from that. But yeah, again, I just see this as the HE sector kind of talking to itself, which I'm not sure is overly helpful.
I mean, on that, Andrea, right? I mean, if you know, I know some schools are pretty big, but it's not as if we take a multi-academy trust and just give it one rating. You know, we look at each of the academies. You know, if I'm a student on, you know, what the statistics would say is a bronze course at what is otherwise a, you know, silver university, I'd be feeling pretty mugged off, wouldn't I?
Yeah, and it's interesting because they do say in the paper that they have spoken to students about how the TEF sort of rankings, the gold, silver, bronze actually influences their decision making. And the narrative is that it doesn't necessarily inform their choice, it affirms their choice. So I think it's an interesting thing around how what the student perception is of those TEF rankings and what it means in terms of affirming where they're in. So whether that bronze is a deterrent for going into that institution or not, or doing a double check as to why they've selected that institution and whether that's the right fit for them, I think is a really interesting thing. I think we risk a little bit, and this might be some interesting feedback from the sector around changing the perception of some of those rankings when they are newish in terms of perception from the students and what that might mean. So I think it would absolutely be, they have asked the students as part of this consultation, their feedback to the OFS is that they would like more clarity around what those rankings mean, gold, silver, bronze. So I think that as part of the consultation would be interesting about how that narrative is put forward, because certainly a number of institutions definitely go out strongly with gold and silver in terms of their branding and marketing materials. So I think it would be interesting to see how the role of those gold, silver, bronze evolve and mature in terms of informing student decision making.
Mm. Now, Debbie, you'll remember this from the team meet. We had our team meeting this week, a bit of insider baseball there, and we had quite an interesting conversation about quality. And right at the end of the conversation, we got news that this was all coming out. And yes, quite a moment, wasn't it? Pass the whiskey. But, I mean, you'll recall that one of the things I said was, look, for me, what quality is what did a student expect to learn? Did they learn it? You know, how did they expect to learn it? And is that what happened? Learning gain has just been completely drops again, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think, well, there's a few things that I feel quite strongly are a sort of core element of any kind of authentic quality system. And one of those is about exploring the kind of thinking around learning gain. So, which, but you know, very, very loosely, what are the things you put in place that demonstrably support the student to kind of get the outcomes that they might be hoping for? And what's the link between those two? How do you understand that in your institution? And I don't think you need, you would sort of hope, I suppose, in people's test statements, they would say something about that. But one of the things we saw from it, from the education gain exercise in the last one, was that this was something that caused the sector to really think about this stuff in a more organized way. That was actually quite helpful. So to see that disappear is really sad. The other sort of aspect of something that I think is really important is a sort of opportunity to be a bit reflective. You see this in Scotland, and this is a different system, but the enhancement led system in Scotland, an opportunity for an institution to say, actually, we can see that we're not doing brilliantly over here, and here's how we're going to improve that. So you de-risk the idea that, you sort of accept, you bake into the system the idea that large and complex institutions will sometimes experience challenges with quality, and that their ability to spot that, to put a plan in place and to kind of execute that plan is really part of the system. And they said, right, we've considered doing that, and we think it's too burdensome, and we're just not going to engage with that, so never mind. The third thing, I think, is about how do you think about the ways that students are part of that quality dialogue within institutions. And I don't think saying, let's hear from what students think in the, triennial TEF submission really cuts that. I think there's got to be much more of a demonstrate to us that you're engaging with students throughout the quality system, so that we can see that the whatever this kind of snapshot that is produced in that submission is grounded in a ongoing process of student engagement. So there's just that thing about the thing that matters is that there is an ongoing conversation about learning and teaching in the institution. And for a quality system, I think you can sort of just demonstrate that relates to outcomes. If your system doesn't really assess that, whether those things are happening or encourage that, I suppose, perhaps rather than assess it, then it doesn't feel very kind of meaningful to me.
I guess, I mean, Andrea, the other thing that really jumped out at me was, fundamentally, For a number of years, OFS has effectively said, look, there are minimums that we expect all providers to hit on getting to the second year, continuation, completing the course, completion, and then getting a graduate job, progression. And it is dropping the minimums on getting a graduate job. Now, I suspect if, we probe that a little bit, OFS would say, well, there's lots of different contexts for lots of different providers. That's what we found since we launched the original metric. But that does mean that fundamentally OFS is holding universities to whether you get to the second year, whether you complete the course. And, is that the right set of incentives for what, that the world would recognise as what a minimum quality would be of a university course?
It's a really challenging one. I think student outcomes has always been slightly contentious in the best way to define what that means. And I think you're right, Jim, from a public perception versus an institutional perception, I think there's some interesting views on what they would be looking for. They do bring in, and it's interesting, and I align this a little bit to, in the consultation talks about expanding those that will be included in TEF moving forward, which is some of the smaller providers, and reference that sort of nuance around how it might need to shape rather than a one size fits all. But I think it's interesting about the narrative they bring about the contextual element to try and reflect some of the challenges in the sort of evidence base, some of the data around how graduate outcomes are classified in some of the LEO and other graduate outcomes data. So I think it's a tricky one to balance, I think, in terms of having the right understanding of what success and outcomes mean. But absolutely, employment should be part of that. It is the primary driver of why people engage in education and pay the fees to do that. So I think there'll be quite a bit of feedback from the sector on that particular change, because I think your point is well made about making sure that absolutely the continuation through a degree is important, but graduate outcomes can't be missed off that, and how that contextual information is included from an objective perspective to drive that sort of equal measure when you're doing the rankings and assessments.
Right, great stuff. More on the site and more doubtless in the coming weeks. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Brian Cullerton, Director of Apprenticeships, Work-Based Learning and Skills at the University of Huddersfield. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the impact of Ofsted inspections on staff delivering apprenticeships in higher education. My research shows that inspections are not just administrative exercises. They're experienced as events, which often leave colleagues feeling stressed, unwell, unsupported, and disillusioned. But what really came through in my research was a sense of institutional neglect. Not toxic leadership, but a lack of engagement and psychological safety for those colleagues who are delivering apprenticeships. It's evident that apprenticeships remain marginalized in many universities, and I argue that inspection readiness and staff well-being need to sit with senior leadership, not with the most overworked teams. Without that shift, the risk of burnout and reputational damage will only continue to grow.
Now, next up, the Public Office Accountability Bill, better known as the Hillsborough Law, has been launched this week. Shane, what's going on here?
Yeah, after a decade, probably more, of campaigning led by the Hillsborough families, the Public Order Accountability Bill was finally introduced in Parliament this week. So the point here is to make public officials and public authorities and the individuals leading the public authorities in some cases, they could face criminal sanctions if they attempt to cover up the facts or hide the truth from inquiries and investigations. The context of this is into, you know, major disasters like the Hillsborough disaster, like Grenfell, through a new misleading the public offence. It's also importantly going to give families access to legal aid for inquests and inquiries to kind of level the playing field a little bit, to address that imbalance of power between the people who are seeking justice and the very expensive government lawyers who represent the state. So this has been on the cards for some time. Like I said, it's been a decade in the making from the campaigner's perspective. Future Prime Minister Andy Burnham tried introducing a law like this when he was back in Parliament, when he was in Parliament last in 2017. But essentially what the families and the campaigners and the survivors have done with this law is they've hopefully seen an end to the sort of, you know, grotesque, prolonged, expensive battles for justice that we've seen when, you know, people, victims, try going up against the state machine to seek justice. So we'll have to see how it progresses through Parliament. It does seem to be universally welcomed. We should be keeping an eye on, you know, amendments and debates as it hits the House of Commons for second reading in the middle of October.
Fascinating stuff. Now, Andrea, I guess, you know, when people think about this and they think about the state, they might not automatically be thinking about universities, but universities are definitely covered here, aren't they? And this idea of kind of criminalizing obstruction or dishonesty, I mean, you know, in the first part of the bill, you know, the reality is universities aren't often involved in kind of major public inquiries, but it's the inquest thing is pretty common, isn't it? You know, this idea that universities will have to change the way they approach student deaths is potentially quite significant.
Absolutely. And I think in reading this, if I put myself in the shoes of someone in an institution, I think, and interestingly reading your blog around this, Jim, earlier in the week, is I think there may be some nervousness from the sector, particularly from those who are at the student end or the frontline staff are engaging in some of these things where, to your point, deaths of students might appear in some of this this conversation. So I think there's a really interesting challenge for universities about how do they consider this as part of the operations and the way they do things, and how do they support those staffs? Have they got the right technology in place to ensure that sort of case management activities are playing through and that the staff are engaging directly with students, have the right access to the right information at the right time? So I think it's going to be quite an interesting challenge and may create some nervousness around the accountability, particularly for those staff who are at the coalface dealing with students directly.
Yeah. It's really interesting stuff, that. Now, Debbie, let me ask you about this ethical code of conduct, because what the bill really does is then, for stuff that isn't a statutory inquiry, it kind of places a new responsibility on universities, doesn't it, to sort of, you know, create an ethical code of conduct, another policy to create, and then sort of embed that throughout. Is that going to work, or is that just going to be another tick box cosmetic?
Well, it's really interesting, because I think it reminds me a little bit of free speech stuff, because you're trying to sort of regulate culture and how people feel about how comfortable and safe people feel to do things and say things that may go against the grain if these kind of principles and policies weren't in place. I think that's quite interesting in itself. I think my first sort of thought goes, if I'm sitting on a board of governors and I am a governor at a new institution, the National Institute of Teaching, new higher education institution, if I was going to ask the head of the institution, okay, how can I be assured as a governor that all of your staff are acting with candor? What would I need to look at to kind of give me that give me that sense. And I think there's a real, there's both the sort of, I guess, the sort of, you need to demonstrate the training and support that is offered, that are offered to staff to think about the what that then looks like in their kind of particular context in the day to day. But you also need, I think, at the leadership level to really think carefully about how you de-risk some of those things. And because I think people do sort of tend to default to thinking this is, it feels risky to put forward, you know, information that may have a kind of reputation, you know, that you feel may have a reputational impact on your department or the other broader institution and all the rest of it. So I think, there's going to have to be some real hard thinking among leaders about how they then embed a culture in which information is shared, you know, on an open and transparent basis, on a regular basis. In the, you know, because actually, in most cases, of course, because the risk here is then that it comes out that it wasn't, not that it comes out, if that makes sense. It just changes the balance of risk, but that's definitely going to be a process.
Yeah, and I guess it's whether the changing of the balance of risk means that, you know, that will change people's kind of calculus every level. You know, is the incentive on one side of the seesaw kind of strong enough? Shane, let me just pick up this question about private providers. You know, one of the things that always strikes me is when you see those round-robin FOIs that go round that apply to public authorities, private providers tend to knee-jerk and say, well, look, we're not covered. And, you know, there's quite a lot of, you know, private provider, for want of a better phrase, involvement in higher education, both inside a large university in terms of service delivery. And then also, there's a lot of private providers either being franchised to or just kind of operating on the OFS register. This whole question of private and public seems a little confused in here. You know, what is a public official?
There's some unusual wording in the bill, sorry, as well. And when you scroll down to the schedules and you look at the list of who the public authorities are, there's obviously the ones you'd expect, government departments, arm's length bodies, etc. And then it says it doesn't say universities at all, but it does say schools and further education providers. And usually in things like this, we expect to see words like further education corporations, which makes it very, very clear that there's a particular category of institution, further education corporations, which are included within the scope of that legislation. And this one says providers, which you know, does then mean we have to ask the question about how that interacts with the very large number of private institutions delivering apprenticeships, delivering courses for young people and adults, and etc. So it does feel like that this is a grey area that's going to need ironing out. I'm one of those people that does do those round robin freedom of information requests on a fairly regular basis. But it's not just those freedom of information policies that we come up against. It's also policies around data protection and around whistleblowing as well. So yes, one, this private public grey area does need to be ironed out. And I would always bat for maximum transparency if you're in receipt of a penny of taxpayers' money. And secondly, how these requirements, the duty of candor, duty to assist, code of conduct, how all of those things interact with, as Debbie said, at a governance level around things like data protection, freedom of information and whistleblowing.
Now, finally this week, the machinery of government changes that have shifted apprenticeships and Skills England to DWP, Andrea.
Excellent. Thanks, Jim. As you mentioned, so the first couple of weeks of September have brought about some reshuffles in government. And as you said, there's been a move from Skills from DfE across to DWP. And it's been interesting as most recently as a couple of days ago, it's been confirmed by government about what that actually means in terms of apprenticeships, adult and further education, skills, training, careers, and Skills England moving across to DWP, and confirmation of the under 19 FE, HE skills training careers remains with DfE. I think it's interesting for Skills England, as its newly created body, be less than 12 months and there's a move of portfolio. And obviously the role of Skills England is to understand the needs from England from a skills perspective, access and the outcomes of the education and training provided in that space. It forms a super ministry. It's under Secretary of State Pat McFadden, and we've retained the Minister for Skills in Baroness Jackie Smith, who in essence will have two reporting lines, one's into DfE and one into DWP. There's been a number of articles and information released, and the sort of key drivers behind this decision making is the join up between skills and jobs. Certainly right concern and a growing concern about the number of young people who are not currently engaged in education, employment or training, aligning the skills better with the labour market. but also navigating some of the welfare and benefits challenges in the UK are the key drivers for that taking place. Mixed reviews, Jim, in terms of the feedback on that. So I look forward to discussing that.
Now, Shane, right? It seems to me that, for example, right, if I was looking at the DWP and DfE, one of the things I'd think about is, well, there's an uneasy relationship between the benefits system in the DWP and the student financing system in DfE. Now, what that causes me to think is civil servants and government departments need to be much, much better at coordinating and talking to each other. But I wouldn't necessarily take one chunk of it and just chuck it into another department with some really weird spider diagram. Or am I, do you know what I mean? Like if we were to do this on all of these cross-cutting difficult issues, we'd end up with utter chaos, wouldn't we?
Well, it feels like since around 2016, when the last time sort of the FE and skills brief was split across two departments was brought to an end and everything was put in DfE. Since then, it feels like we've been on a journey on silo, breaking down silos and, you know, trying to create some coherence from, you know, early years to higher education. And there's a bunch of things going on here. Firstly, the extent to which, from a number 10 perspective, this is all part of phase two. Are we still in phase two? Phase two of Keir Starmer's kind of delivery mode following Angela Rayner's resignation. We understand that the skills brief was something that Pat McFadden specifically asked for in taking on that TWP role. Skills has bounced around all kinds of departments. And there's a case for it to be in also, you could put skills in business where it used to be. You could put the adult a bit of adult education in health if you really wanted to. You know, there's all sorts of arguments on where it can be. The real practical challenges now are going to be, I think, on a policy level. So there's quite a lot of nervousness, as you mentioned, Jim, around kind of, if you think of, I don't know about you, when I think of DWP, I think benefit sanctions. I think of those horrible return to work assessments that people who can't work have to go through. It feels like a more kind of aggressive, punitive arm of the state. And there's a little bit of uncomfortableness about, you know, vice chancellors having to wander into DWP now to talk about degree apprenticeships, etc. I do think they should change the name of the department and give it a bit of a rebrand. I understand that's not on the cards, but on a policy level, how are all of these things going to link together? Pat McFadden keeps giving interviews to largely right-wing newspapers talking about things like tackling youth unemployment, which has always been DWP's brief, even before he was given the skills portfolio, and cracking down on the number of young people that leave education and don't go into work. What he's not answered yet is why the current system that DWP has introduced is moving so slowly. He doesn't seem to be bringing any new ideas to the table just yet, although it is early days. But he is, I think, giving a bit of a sense of direction about using benefit rules, sanctions, and education, access to training into the same kind of basket, which is going to be a change for us. There are some rules of around universal credit already, and the extent to which you can engage in 16 hours of training and things like that. But, you know, if he does want to bring down the benefits bill, if he does want to try and use his arm of government to get more young people specifically into the workplace, he's going to have to go a lot harder.
I mean, Debbie, one of the things that really does strike me actually is, you know, one of the things I keep coming back to is actually the childcare thing, where, you know, if you're a full-time student and therefore looked after by, you know, the student loans company, DfE, whatever, you can't get the same childcare offer, the free childcare offer that, you know, people in work can get. And this feels like in some ways, actually, it might make that split between government, you know, kind of Whitehall's assumptions about, you know, employment and work and being a student. You know, this idea of being a student feels like it's now with DfE is full time and is for really young people. Like, am I overcooking that? It just feels very odd.
I think what you're describing is the kind of, I guess, because it's something you've been arguing for a long time, Jim, is that if there was better join up between different government departments, some of the consequences would be about thinking about the ways that being a student intersects with citizenship and work and, you know, ability to move about in your geographical space and, you know, and family life and caring responsibilities and all the rest of that. And that if government was able to do that, then what, you know, there could be some actually some really kind of thoughtful, radical, you know, a sort of an explosion of kind of access to education in some ways, because you would create these kind of brilliant sort of interactions. And I suppose you could look at it through that lens and say there's a real opportunity here to find some of those weird tensions that have grown up over the years and undo them and rethink. But I'm not sure that's I think we should absolutely make the case for that via things like the Post-18 Project and so on. But I suspect that's not going to happen organically. You know, that it's going to have to be a bit of thought given to it. And I think, I mean, I go back and forth on this a little bit because, I mean, I was at dinner the other week and a former minister was there and he put the sort of, I guess, the standard critique of universities' kind of sense of disconnect from that broader kind of skills landscape. And, you know, sort of saying, think about graduate skills, think about graduate employability, think about, you know, delivering the skills the region needs and all the rest of it. And I know lots and lots of heads of institutions were thinking about what that means for them and what that might look like in practice. I do think that, you know, with, you know, in all honesty, in a government that's got an awful lot to deliver, you know, there's an awful lot of kind of need in the country, and that really there's something here about saying that we've got nearly 1 million young people not in education, employment and training, and universities, you know, can absolutely play a role in kind of tackling and engaging in that policy agenda and sort of thinking about what their role is. It's not to say that they shouldn't be, but, you know, this I think is about sort of saying, let's really tackle these areas where the biggest need is, probably not about ironing out some of these weird anomalies, despite, you know, without, you know, with a completely understanding of the those anomalies are real and they have real impacts on people's lives. But there's a real kind of, I think the first thing that everyone's going to be thinking about is about sort of saying, okay, how do we tackle this problem? How do we address this challenge in that sort of very pointy end of the skills agenda? And I think DfE will just continue to sort of say and do things about graduate skills and employability.
Andrew, if I just look at the sort of politics of it, right? So I'm assuming that Keir Starmer says to Pat McFadden, right, you know this mess we got ourselves into over benefits. Well, Rachel next door has still got no money. And in fact, she's got less money. So I need my top sort of bruiser to take that on. And then maybe Pat went, well, one of the fig leaves I'm going to need to get through the autumn or the winter when we still go ahead and cut benefits is I'm going to need to really prove that we've got people off benefits and into skills and apprenticeships. Now, if that's an oversimplified version of what has gone on, and it's, you know, I think that's probably a decent bet. Certainly Shane implied that. That doesn't half leave policy coherence in a real mess, doesn't it, for universities? Because universities aren't really part of that story, are they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think in reading some of the responses that have been published to the shift, I think there is a bit of a fear, and it's not true for everyone's view. And there's definitely recognition of the benefits of putting some of these together and tackling some of these core issues for the UK. But there's a bit of a fear that higher education might be forgotten a little bit, or we don't get the join up between education from sort of cradle to grave, if you forgive that expression, right the way through, that things get forgotten, things might be delayed for the HG sector as well. We know we've got the post-16 paper coming out imminently as well. That creates delays. Does it change some of the focus? And do we sort of fall off the radar a little bit from a higher education perspective? So I think the greatest challenge and when you think about education, it does sort of fit across many of the portfolios in government as well about the ability to influence and work with. So I think the greatest challenge will be structural change and the focus around that skills and employment and benefits, but not losing sight of that broader picture and some of the HE elements being lost in that conversation with a renewed focus. So I guess that is then the need for Jackie Smith and her role to really work effectively across those two areas to keep that join up. And hopefully, as we see the paper come out towards the back end of this year, the post-16 paper, that might help bring some of that together about actions to address a specific need, but not without that sort of broader view about the education for the UK more broadly at different levels.
Shane, you were watching the select committee the other day, and I noticed a couple of screenshots. You know, I mean, old-fashioned me here, as well as all the kind of issues and implications for, you know, universities and colleges and individual students, you know, there is a kind of accountability issue, isn't there, potentially, in terms of, you know, where does a written question go? You know, all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it does really cement Jackie Smith's role in the government. You know, she was already, you know, she's the Lords Minister at the Department for Education as well, as we know. So she's leading the Schools and Children's Bill through the House of Lords at the moment. Meanwhile, at DfE, she's still got her 16 to 19 19 and below careers brief. And she's also now got this DWP with a separate Secretary of State to report to, who is, you know, very different in style and approach to Bridget Phillipson. And I'd say as well, if you look at Jackie Smith's style, I guess, as a minister, I think she does probably more align to Pat McFadden's approach, which is, you know, much more upfront, quite direct. Whereas, you know, Bridget Phillipson is generally very measured, generally very scripted. Jackie and Pat McFadden aren't. I think I can see those two working quite well together. But, you know, say a question comes in on local skills improvement plans, that would be a DWP response. But say a question comes in on occupational standards for T levels, well, that will also be a DWP, because occupational standards sit within Skills England, but T levels sit within DfE. So there are going to be these quirks that are going to need to be ironed out. We also there is a Josh McAllister Josh McAllister speaks for FE in the House of Commons, because obviously Jackie Smith is in the House of Lords. He's a DfE minister. There's going to now need to be a Jackie Smith representative on the DWP benches, on the front bench, on the government front bench as well. Quite relieved to see that DWP already has its own Lords minister, Maeve Sherlock. So, you know, that's one less thing for the skills minister, Jackie Smith, to be worried about. But there are going to be these quirks. The DWP Select Committee is suddenly very important to us as a sector now, and there are some good people on it. People like Debbie Abrahams, very, very experienced as the chair. So yes, some quirks, but ultimately I do think I like to align myself with what, you know, others have said about there being a bigger voice for skills across government. And, you know, if I don't know the extent to which Bridget was a champion for skills at the cabinet table to begin with, but to have two cabinet ministers, at least in theory, batting for the sector can only be a good thing this side of a difficult budget.
Bridget might be very busy soon, given her other job application. Now, just before we come off this, and you know, I'm conscious that actually, you know, a lot of this is quite, always got to think about devolution. And of course, one of the quirks here is that DWP will pick up skills for England, but DWP has wider kind of, you know, UK-wide responsibilities. You know, Jackie Smith is very busy, very busy. And it looks like, so, you know, we've got a couple of new junior ministers in DfE, and former Edinburgh University Students Association president, Josh McAllister, the inventor of the Student-Led Teaching Award, there we go, looks like he's going to be taking on the university's brief.
Well, that's really interesting, because Josh, he also, as well as inventing Student-Led Teaching Awards, invented the social work sort of fast-track scheme, didn't he? I can't remember what the name of it was. So he's definitely a bit of a mover and shaker. I mean, I think it definitely nice to have, given how busy Jackie Smith will be, is and will continue to be. It'll certainly be useful to have another kind of point of contact in DfE to kind of, you know, be in the conversation and, I guess, triangulate a little bit. But I also suspect that Josh is probably quite ambitious and may not stay in DfE for very long. I wouldn't be surprised if he's tipped as a sort of future star. So I think a good individual to build a relationship with. But you know, the extent to which he's going to be actually shaping policy around higher education reform and all the rest of it, I think is probably a bit up in the air at the minute.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Andrea, Shane, Debbie, Michael Salmon, who makes it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.